Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We all have baseball fever as the World Series continues between our Cardinals and the Red Sox. Another way of looking at their first series meeting in 1946, just a little bit later in the program. But first, another way of looking at Old Man River, the mighty Mississippi that's far beyond Mark Twain. The river is something most of us take pretty much for granted. Fortunately for history buffs, river rats, and those who just love the river for its lore and legend, our guest on today's program has done anything but take the river for granted. Historian author Paul Schneider's latest book is Old Man River, the Mississippi River in North American History. He's also the author of such other books of diverse subject matter as The Adirondacks and Bonnie and Clyde. He has many others as well. Paul, so nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I don't know whether I should disrupt the mood by telling folks that you grew up in Massachusetts, so you might be looking at these games that are currently going on a little bit differently than most of our listeners.
Well, you know, that's true. I am from Massachusetts, mea culpa, and I'm just psyched to have a great series. Let's just leave it at that.
A wacky series, but
great fun. Yeah. And couldn't be. My mom's from St. Louis, though, actually. So the Cards have always been my favorite National League team when they're not playing the Red Sox.
Well, let's see
that's worth.
Well, let's see how it unfolds. You know, you say in your book that you suffer from something called river madness. What is that all about?
I love rivers. I mean, it's interesting. I've through incredible good fortune in the form of love and marriage, I've ended up living by the sea, and I've grown to become sort of a salty ocean lover. But I grew up next to the Connecticut River, which is actually where Mark Twain ended up living. Mm-hmm. And just as a kid, I always my family didn't have a ton of money. We made our own fun. And generally what we did was ride our bikes out to the Connecticut River and figure out, you know, something we could float up or down or steal a canoe, or borrow a canoe or whatever. And I just grew up feeling this sense of rivers, you know, going up and down and where they could take you. And the first thing I bought, actually, with my own money, I picked corn for a summer and bought a canoe. But it was pretty poorly thought out because I was too young to drive, and I couldn't get the canoe anywhere without convincing my dad to go and put it on the car. But I did have it, and I still have it. Anyway, so the chance came to write this book, and it was just like a dream come true for me. It was an excuse to travel all over the watershed. I did a lot of – I took my own son out, and we paddled down big stretches of the river. I took a little boat by myself on a huge trips, you know. Yeah. So it was fun. I mean –
several segments of the book, which I've read, by the way, and really enjoyed, and
Thank you.
I mentioned to you off the air, learned an awful lot. There were some things I guess maybe I've forgotten with regard to some of the history of our country, the founding of our country, and Civil War and War of 1812 and that sort of thing. But those segments you wrote about being on the river with your son struck me as very, very important to the book in explaining your interest in the river, but also the bonding opportunity there.
Yeah, it was, you know, obviously for me as a dad, it was, you know, some of the most fun parts. I mean, I should say the book is not a book that's built around my trip down the Mississippi River with my son. There's just little interludes of travel. But it kind of is important to me in the kind of book that it is because while I do subscribe to the old adage that those who, you know, forget history are doomed to repeat it, although I'm not so sure. There's a lot of people making the same mistakes out there who should know better. But I love history because I feel like, getting back to baseball, like a person who really knows the rules of the game and knows the players and knows the history is going to enjoy a baseball game more than somebody who is just a neophyte, who just has come to it and doesn't even know, you know, what obstruction is, who among us did know what that was. But so too with history, for me, knowing the history of a place is what brings the present alive. I mean, I love to sort of know what was here and what was there. And so travel for me is intimately connected with writing history. Hmm. I love to go to these places. And so for this kind of book, I just went ahead and stuck myself in it in a few places to kind of also say, look, this is not like a history of the War of 1812. For instance, the war's come and gone. It's 200 years ago. It's not there anymore. But the Mississippi River is right out there. It's still there, rolling by, you know.
What did the river say to you when you were on it?
Boy, a thousand things. You know, it says something different all the time. I mean, interestingly, that's a good question and one that would deserve some thought. But at some points, when you get on the river and you're traveling at it on its own pace, you know, particularly with my son, we would sneak ashore whatever. We'd stash the boats in the woods and go into little towns like Herculaneum or wherever. And if there was a hotel, we'd stay in it for a night or two, take a shower, get cleaned up, watch some ball games. In that mm-hmm. case, it was basketball. And then when you come back to the river's kind of like, where you been? Mm-hmm. I mean, you feel like you have this you get this kind of relationship with it when you're traveling on it. It also said to me, you know, take care of me. I mean, I think that's really – we as Americans, we don't – a lot of – St. Louis is fabulous because they really have recognized the value of the waterfront. The waterfront is a beautiful, big, you know, revived part of it, of the city. But there are plenty of towns and cities up and down the river that have just turned their backs on it, pretend it's not there, just only think about it when it's going to flood. And that's unfortunate yeah. because it really is kind of like a fourth coastline. I mean, we should be looking at it as a great recreational opportunity in addition to economics and history.
Yeah. I found that, which is the last part of your book, dealing with the pollution and what is in that river and the fact that there aren't that many stewards, not as many as there should be. But I was saddened by that, given everything that preceded it in the book.
It is sad to some degree that the river is as polluted as it is and as hemmed in as it is by engineering, mm-hmm. Although there's reasons for both. Although I would qualify that sadness. It's interesting. I was up in Davenport at the – I did a little book event at the River Bandits. It's like a little triple – Double A. I don't know how many A's they got. A little minor league park, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were standing there, and actually there was a fellow who was running for governor of Illinois there also, and he said something about, you know, no more regulation, no more this, no more that. And I was looking out at the river. The park looks right over the river, and I thought, well, if we were here before Congress, you know, operated long enough to bipartisanly override Nixon's veto of the Clean Water Act, you wouldn't want to be in this baseball park mm-hmm. looking this close to the mm-hmm. river. I mean, so as polluted as it is today by farm runoff, it's so immeasurably cleaner than it was in 1969 or 1970 that we also should recognize that we've come an incredibly long way. I mean, I traveled up and down the whole river, and there's no places on it, at least when I was on it, where it was, you know, some stench or something. You didn't want to be on the river. Right. You didn't want to drink it, and you didn't necessarily want to swim in it. But it's full of fish. It's full of life. It's full of eagles. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. There's a lot to be done, but there's a lot that's been done.
Right. Let's backtrack a little
okay.
bit. We started talking about the end of the book, and
yeah.
we can come back to that. But I was particularly fascinated by the beginning about the origins of the river. You mentioned earlier on that you've become kind of a saltwater guy.
Yeah.
Well, saltwater was pretty much around the area we're in right now at one time, wasn't it?
Yeah, that is fascinating. And when the Rockies first, it's kind of hard to describe just by words, but when the Rocky Mountains first started to rise and kind of create the western side of the watershed, the Appalachian Mountains are much, much older, and so they were always there. But at first, when the two plates came together, the land in the middle kind of buckled downward, like if you took a piece of cardboard and pushed it mm-hmm. together at the sides, which is what was sort of happening. The middle could pop up or it could pop down. And at first it popped down and it all flooded. And for, you know, tens of millions of years, there was this shallow sea between the Rockies and the Appalachians where the Mississippi is today. And it was full of, you know, sharks and mosasaurs and weird kind of giant prehistoric beasts. And so that's why, you know, you can find fossils of sea creatures down in the Ozarks, all over the place in the valley.
Shark's teeth in the mud.
Shark's teeth in the mud, yeah.
That was one of the most surprising things that I read in the book.
Yeah.
So what happened? I mean, obviously, it contracted at some point. Did it contract to a river, of what we know as a river?
No, what geologists think happened is as the Pacific plate pushed up against the North American plate and the Rockies really began to rise, it just gradually uplifted. It was sliding under the other plate. So even though it buckled down for a while, eventually it got pushed up out of the water. And the ocean then just receded both north and south back out. It was called something like the Great Interior Seaway. I can't remember the exact term.
Why is it called the Mississippi? Its source is in Minnesota, supposedly Mississippi's several hundred miles downriver.
Well, it got the name because the French arrived in the middle of the 1600s, sort of at Green Bay up in Wisconsin, and they started hearing from the Indians about this river that the Indians called Mississippi. So the name Mississippi was a name for the upper Mississippi, for the Minnesota, the river up in Minnesota and in. And it didn't mean father of waters. It just meant big, big, long river that goes on forever. So that name stuck all the way down. Actually, so the state is named after the river, which was an Indian name for the northern part of the river. So that's how that happened.
One of our producers mentioned this morning, prior to your arrival, that it was his understanding that the Mississippi is actually a tributary of the Missouri, that early mapping had things kind of fouled up. That doesn't strike me as being right, but you would know better than I.
Well, the Mississippi River above St. Louis is called the Upper Mississippi, and it goes to Lake Itasca, as everybody knows. Mm-hmm. It has the pride of name, but it's not the longest tributary. If you want to start in New Orleans and go as far as you can, the longest journey you can take on the river, you would take a left at St. Louis and go up the Missouri. So the Missouri is, or as my mom always told me, because she's from down the southern part, it's Missouri. It's not Missouri. Mm-hmm. So, but the Missouri River is far longer. You know, it goes all the way on up into Yellowstone and beyond into the Rockies. So if you're just looking for the longest river, if that's the definition, then yes, it's true that the upper Mississippi joins the Missouri because the Missouri is longer. But interestingly, at Cairo, or Cairo.
Better call it Cairo.
where the Ohio comes in, the Ohio brings twice as much water to the party as any two it brings more water to the party than any two other tributaries combined. So even though it's shorter, it brings all the water. So it's kind of a game of definitions. But interestingly, the Arkansas and the Red River of the South are also longer than the upper Mississippi. So the upper Mississippi, with no offense to it, because it's extraordinarily beautiful and long, is, you know, not necessarily the main stem.
You used the term watershed before, and most people probably understand what that is. But for those who don't, what do you mean when you speak of the watershed?
When I speak of the watershed, it's the same as if I were to say the basin or the – it means any water that falls into this area called the watershed is going to end up some point in the Mississippi River – going into the Gulf of Mexico. So it's at the top of the line along the Appalachians, where if you took a step this way, you're going to go into the Tennessee River and then into the Ohio and then into the Mississippi. And if you step that way, you're going to end up in the Potomac and the Atlantic on that side. And then it's the similarly at the Continental Divide on the Rocky side. And up north, it's somewhere between the Great Lakes and where things start to flow south. I mean, it's been a little bit manipulated because Chicago changed the direction of the Chicago River. So now you can actually go all the way up into the Great Lakes and on.
You point out, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think the figure was 41% of all the rivers and streams in the country come into the Mississippi at some point through this watershed.
41% of the land mass of the continental United States flows into the Mississippi. I don't know the number in terms of number of streams and rivers. But it's a huge, huge chunk.
There are a lot.
Paul Schneider is our guest. He is the author of Old Man River, the Mississippi River, and North American History. We'll come back and continue our conversation. If you'd like to get in on it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet if you like at STL on air. Back with Paul Schneider in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Paul Schneider, who is the author of Old Man River, the Mississippi River, and North American History. You know, another one of the interesting things, and again, I suppose people who thought about it would realize that this sort of thing went on, was the bloodshed along the river. During the time of the French explorers and the Indians, they were fighting the French, they were fighting each other. Cannibalism, I mean, there was just an awful lot going on.
Yeah, it's a long and bloody story of – you know, and it's not all perpetrated entirely just by the Europeans. I mean, you know, when the English start to come in to the East Coast and the French start to trickle down, it sets off a kind of waves of dislocated people, some Indian groups moving forward. The Iroquois in particular wanted to control the fur trade, which took them, and they wanted to control the entire Ohio Valley and as much of the upper Mississippi as they possibly could, and it brought them into incredible Indian wars in which the French and the English participated. What was surprising and to me as a historian was how much material really is available. I mean, how detailed some of the accounts from the French explorers and the French missionaries and the American fur traders and even George Washington's journals, you know, of specific Indians, specific people, specific stories about these battles that can bring it to life in a way that was great for a writer to find these things.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of material, obviously. French names are so familiar to us in this area and, of course, familiar to everyone, Marquette and Joliet and LaSalle. I mean, they all played significant roles. How intrepid must these fellas have been to take off in the middle of winter in canoes through Indian country to do a little mapping and exploring?
It is astonishing, really, when you think about what some of these fellows endured. I mean, in some ways – The French were very adept at it. They'd been on the Great Lakes for 150 years. Some of these guys who traveled with, you know, Nicolet and Joliet and those guys spoke five or six Indian languages. They traveled with Indian companions. So they were kind of old hands at traveling back in the country. But it is astonishing. And almost more than that they could survive in semi-hostile Native American territory is kind of some of the crossings they made in the middle of the winter. I mean, just the raw survival. LaSalle, who is one of the great characters of American history. I mean, he's just a half crazy, half, you know, incredible, half madman. You know, he crossed the Great Lakes by himself with a dog across the snow all the way to Montreal, you know. And it just sets off on these journeys that those of us would think twice about doing it today with a train ticket.
And they were not always on the river. There were times when they had to carry the portage, whatever it was they were sailing in.
Yeah, they were not always on the river. I mean, and it's particularly at Chicago when they start to come across from there and they learn that that's the easiest route. You know, the French first come through, as I mentioned earlier, Green Bay and down the Wisconsin River. But then actually the Indians tell them on their way back up the river, they kind of say, you know, I don't know why we're going all the way up to Wisconsin. If you really want to go to Montreal, we just take this right turn here on the Illinois and we can go up to Chicago. Chicago was their word too, kind of like Mississippi. Mm-hmm. We got this place called Chicago where you can cross right over, you know. So it's interesting how the information – we think of them as these explorers as traveling in sort of unknown territory, you know, that we have no idea. But in fact, they had Indians who knew the whole place pretty well and said, hey, no, it's a shortcut here. Let's go right.
That's another interesting part of it, the fact that the Indians did know the whole place. I mean, they knew that the Mississippi ultimately went down to what they would call the ocean or what the explorers called the ocean. They did an awful lot of traveling themselves, obviously.
They did. The Iroquois in particular, at least during that that few hundred years, you know, from the beginning of European until about the French and Indian War. You know, they traveled a lot, often in hostile bands, you know, war parties. But they did seem to know, you know, they knew their territory. It wasn't sort of this idea that, you know, they lived in some village and didn't know what was downriver or upriver.
There are a lot of things going on in the book, and we can't touch upon all of them, and we want people to read it, so we don't want to discuss all of them necessarily. But I'd like you to connect the dots for me between George Washington, the river and rivers, and the founding of this country. There are connect links there.
It was sort of astonishing to me, actually, considering I probably know a reasonable amount of history, having written four books previously to this, all on North American historical topics, that I had no real concept of how important the Mississippi watershed and the Ohio River watershed, those two rivers, which are all part of one, but how important the Mississippi was to the founding of this country. From the point that George Washington's first taste of battle, he's a young man, he's sent up to Pittsburgh basically at the top of the Ohio River to tell the French to get lost, and ends up sparking this 7 years' war, what we call the French and Indian War, which was a huge battle between the English and the French that went on all five continents, but ended up resulted in the French being kicked out of North America altogether. So right there, it's about the Mississippi River is how the war starts. That means we now speak English in St. Louis instead of French in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And going forward from there, even with leading up to the Revolution, the taxes that the Tea Partiers were – the real Tea Partiers were, you know, throwing tea off the boats, those taxes were being raised to fight wars in the Ohio and the upper Mississippi by the English. And the soldiers that the colonists didn't want stationed in their homes were not being stationed there to keep watch over the colonists. They were being stationed there so that they could go fight in the Ohio Valley in the summer months. You know, so even those kind of battles, and then even more so, King George, after the French were kicked out, said, no, you English colonists can't go over there and settle. That's my Indian people's country. And that, of course, you know, George Washington, no surveyors in the Ohio Valley? I don't think so. No. So it's in the, you know, it's in the Declaration and the Articles. Anyway, it's fascinating stuff.
It absolutely is. And in some ways, it's a more interesting way, the way you've approached that part of the history, using the river as kind of the focal point. In some ways, it's even more interesting than the way we traditionally learn it.
Well, it is. To me, it's fascinating. And it's it just carries on from there on, because even after independence, the one thing the new national government has is land in the Ohio and the Mississippi River Valley. They don't have any land. They don't have anything. They're in debt. So their whole national government is also basically born and funded out of how do you develop the Mississippi Valley.
Yeah. One of the other things I wanted to talk about, among many, is something that we hear about from time to time here, and that is the New Madrid earthquakes of 1811 and 1812. A big part of both legend and lore, if you will, of this river, and some myth. I mean, I've heard, and you write in your book, that it rang church bells in Boston. There are some people today who would say that really didn't happen, nor did they ring them in New Orleans, nor that the river ran backwards. But you say it did run backwards for a couple of days.
I don't think I said it ran backwards for a couple of days. I hope I didn't say that. But I think that there's definitely accounts of it. It was more like a backwash, like a wave, like a tidal wave. You know, it was more like a wave that ran back up the river. It didn't actually flow backwards for any period of time. But there are definitely accounts of it washing boats on up the tributaries and up into the woods, you know, it and overflowed. And it interestingly had a small waterfall for a while, which, you know, because it's a muddy bottom, was very quickly eliminated. But, you know, it was an unhappy flatboatman who came around the corner and, you know, suddenly saw a 4-foot waterfall where there had, you know, on the lower Mississippi, that's pretty huge.
And there were times when they could see sand. There was no water at all for a brief period of time. Correct.
That's
as a result of this.
Those are, you know, in the descriptions. Yeah. You know, what people saw in the middle of a an earthquake like that, you know, you're most likely not taking good notes, and you know, obviously these things get exaggerated. But interestingly, back to the other point, that was the very first federal disaster relief was for the New Madrid earthquakes. Mm-hmm. So so the first federal disaster relief comes out to the Mississippi.
Another one of those. Yeah. Another one of those connections.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, if folks want to see some evidence of what the river was doing at that time, Real Foot Lake in Tennessee was created by that backwash, and is a pretty good site. You can still see the tops of trees growing out of that lake now.
Yeah.
Let's move it along. We'll skip the War of 1812.
Okay.
And move along to the Civil War, because that, you talk about events in history that helped shape this country. That the Mississippi River played a huge role there, particularly with regard to Vicksburg.
It's remarkable. I mean, basically, I think that you can – well, first of all, I'm not a Civil War historian, and there are, countless, as you know, there are probably more books about the Civil War than any other topic in American history. But I think it's safe to say that many military historians and even many politicians and strategists at that time feel that the war between the states was won and lost on the Mississippi River. And it's it divided the Confederacy. And there was a long history of Southern historians in particular who complained afterwards, as much as they loved Robert E. Lee and Jeff Davis, that they didn't understand why, in their opinions, that the South paid so much attention to trying to capture Washington, trying to capture the Capitol, and less attention trying to protect the river. Now, that's a little bit disingenuous, because they actually did put up a big fight on the river, and they were just basically beaten by the Northern boats under Grant coming down and under Farragut coming up.
What was the importance of the river?
Well, the importance of the river is two or threefold. But if you think about it, it split the Confederacy in half. I mean, we don't often imagine how important Texas and Arkansas were to the Confederacy. But basically, the blockade of the ports, of the southern ports, was so effective that the South could not export anything out of its traditional ports. And so the only way it could get exports out once the bottom of the river was closed was across the river and down through Texas and out through Mexico. So that's the only way they can get hard currency. It's also – Texas was where all their beef was coming from in the second half of the war. So if the North could control that crossing point, they could essentially split the thing in two, choke off the Old South, and then take care of Texas later.
So it was a question of supply lines on the one hand and the economy.
Primarily, primarily. On the other. But interestingly, the fall of New Orleans was internationally incredibly important, because England and France were both kind of flirting with recognizing the Confederacy. Not necessarily because they were pro-slave, but in England's case, they wanted the cheap cotton, and they didn't want to see the United States become as big a power, and figured they were getting – it was just as well to have two countries over there. But with the fall of New Orleans, both France and England realized – and there are letters from the ambassadors, the American ambassadors over there saying, they've now said, we'll never recognize the Confederacy, and the Confederacy was never recognized by any foreign country.
Big. That was big.
That was really big.
There's no question about it. As time begins to wind down for us, Paul Schneider, we can't talk about the river without talking about the music. We can talk about the steamboats, and we can talk about the barge traffic and all the rest of it. But another commodity that went up and down the river was the music, and you address that in your book.
Yes. I mean, it was interesting. It was kind of a mystery to me. I was trying to understand why it is that, pretty much every great American roots type of music, where, we all think about jazz from New Orleans and probably blues from the Delta, but it's also country music coming off of the Tennessee River, and Western music, and they're all basically and Zydeco, they're all basically coming out of the Mississippi River. And I came to believe ultimately that what it was even though the eastern cities were kind of richer and bigger, they were surprisingly less connected with each other. And on the river, in an age before there's recording, before there's broadcasting, there's no radio shows, nobody can hear anybody else's music except on a, something like the Mississippi River, where everybody, blacks, slaves, Native Americans, you know, German immigrants, Irish folks, you know, everybody's traveling in these boats, and they end up all together at night in these stories of these accounts. You know, every night they just play music and trade music and mix it up. And, you know, of course, the real hotbed becomes New Orleans, where it's all kind of mixed in. So it becomes this sort of heartland of American music and also American cultural heroes. I mean, even the cowboy started out as the Riverman. It was like Mike Fink and these crazy, you know. I mean, the other things to not neglect in the river, and I kind of just mentioned it, are the sort of sadder sides, which is it's very implicated with slavery. I mean, it was a slave state unto itself, the river, in many ways.
And the source of a great deal of migration, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Both forced, both happy migration and unhappy migration. But yeah, it's the route through which the whole Midwest is filled. I mean, it's just, if I could have figured out a way to spend my whole life writing this book, you know, you can study it forever.
You must have spent a good part of your life writing this book because you cover so many bases. I mean, the history and the origins of the river, you're going back millennia, needless to say.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a good part. I spent almost 4.5 solid years on it. And if you throw in that I'd already written a book about the Spanish conquistadors, so I already knew that whole story, which is another, you know, it's a lot of time. But it's good to have to finish something too.
Well, that Spanish influence too was early on before the French.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there were things going on. You can take a moment or two to recount some of that.
Well, it's interesting. The Spanish, you know, because we think of them as having these incredible military victories over the Aztecs and the Incas, which are always considered to be more quote unquote civilized, advanced cultures than North American Indians. But when the Spanish come in three or four different big armies to North America, they just get their backsides kicked, you know, to put a radio word on it, you know, and the Spanish are defeated. De Soto, who, you know, winds up buried in the bottom of the Mississippi. Right. And they go off and say, well, there's no gold in them, our hills, and those guys are too tough for us. You know, and they leave behind pigs and horses and diseases, which makes it a little easier for the French and the English when they come down a couple hundred years later.
He was actually chased down the river, was he not?
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. The account from – there's this one survivor's account. There's a guy called the Gentleman of Elvis, which is kind of a cool name. Yes. It's sort of like – and he describes it quite dramatically of the Spanish kind of huddled in their boats under mats just being pounded by these Indians. And we think, Indians in canoes, but these are canoes that – could hold 70 people. I mean, these are big boats. These are bigger than the Mayflower, you know, out of giant cypress trees.
We still have some time left for telephone calls at 382-8255 if you'd like to talk to Paul Schneider. Maybe you have a favorite river memory or a story that you'd like to tell in the time that we have left. Give us a call, 382-8255. Paul, you alluded to the engineers early on in this program and the impact they've had on the river. You know, you're well aware, as we are here, of the number of floods we've had in recent years. And I've covered a number of them, and I've talked to a number of farmers who do not like the levees. They say, let the river do what it's going to do, and we'll all be better off. I get the feeling you feel the same way.
We'll all be better off. Yeah, I do feel ultimately the same way. I mean, I think that's particularly true of the levees. I mean, it's a harder call with the navigational improvements, which also cause a lot of problems. But, you know, it is the busiest waterway in the world. 90% of our exports do go down, of our agricultural exports, you know, go down the Mississippi. So even though all of those navigation elements have problems in terms of what they do for the river, that's a harder call. But the levees, in general, I think, have been proven over 200 years to cause more problems than they help. They generally stop all the minor floods, which would replenish fields and would, you know, and then they ironically seem to make the worst floods even worse.
as was the case in 93 being one of the most notable ones. That was a doozy.
Yeah, that was a doozy. Well, and then there was just the one in
2011. Yeah.
And yeah, and I was on the river the year after that. I was on the river the year before that and the year after that. Actually, I wasn't fortunately traveling on the river during that, but I was in Memphis the year after that, 1 year after that, and in a little, I took this little 14-foot tin boat, aluminum boat, all the way down the Ohio and all the way down past Memphis. And I was sitting in Memphis has a public boatyard, and I was sitting there with the guy who runs it, and he pointed up at this, you know, up on this post. It's one of those floating docks that goes up, and it was 50 feet up, you know. He said, yeah, that's where we were last year, you know. And I knew it kind of from reading it, but I had no, you know, no idea how high that was.
People who have not experienced and witnessed flooding really don't have much of an idea as to what it can do. Let's take a call. We have Ron joining us from St. Louis. Ron, thanks for being on the program. Go ahead.
Thanks very much. I'd like to know if he's talked yet about Cape Girardeau and its position there, why it got the name Cape, and then the effects of the flood all the way over to, well, up the diversion channels, over to Dutch Town Lake. My grandmother lived there for years. Just like to know about that.
Well, that's a good question. I can't tell you definitively why it got the name Cape. Maybe you know. Do you know?
Well, there's a jetty out in the river, and somebody called it Cape Rock. I think that's where it got its name, for a Frenchman who had settled there, Cape Girardeau.
Uh-huh.
And that was the way it came to get its name, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I believe there was a fur trader there. It was an early settlement, and I think there was a fur trader there who probably, you know, was Girardeau, but I'm just kind of guessing at this point. When I was paddling the river with my son the year before the big floods, the river was nevertheless coming up, and we ended up coming into Cape Girardeau. Now has that big wall between it and the river. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And we came right up there and actually pulled out there because the river was coming up too much. And as for the opening and the diversion, I mean, that is a tough call, you know. And they opened it theoretically to save Cairo, which, you know, you don't want to be on the losing end of that, you know. You don't want to be the guy who's got the water coming in your doors.
Thank you so much for the call, Ron. Let's bring in Bill calling from Wentzville. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Several years ago, flying back from Boston, I sat next to a fella. I happened to get upgraded to first class, and we got talking about where I was from, and it turned out he was an Englishman from London, Lloyd's of London, coming to St. Louis like that on insurance business related to the river. And he said that he told me that the Mississippi is the heaviest tonnage and shipment of any river in the world, and that they do a huge, huge amount of insurance business out of London. I thought that was kind of interesting to me anyway.
That is interesting. And it is the case that it is the busiest river in the world. And we sort of spoke a little bit about that. And you know, traveling on it, you definitely see that. I mean, I was on it, and sometimes it's like I was on the river going down. I was below New Madrid, and I was kind of on my little boat, and I was like, wow, I'm getting really hungry. I wonder why I'm getting hungry. And all of a sudden, I was like, that smells like corn muffins around here. And then this huge barge came around the corner, just totally loaded with corn. I was like, oh, that's why I'm hungry. I mean, there is so much activity going up and down the river. You know, so it is there are good and bad sides to all the engineering.
I was on the river road along the Missouri yesterday, and some of those barges and tows are just incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard to imagine pushing that much stuff around with a single tow. Let's take one more quick call. This will be from Lenny in St. Louis. It's got to be quick, though. Lenny, go ahead.
That's fine. I wanted to emphasize with the comment Paul made earlier about traveling the river and getting out and then coming back 2 days later, and if the river says, where you been? Every year my son and I go fishing on the Bighorn for trout in Montana. And every year I get that feeling as I get back in the boat, the river's saying, welcome back, where you been? And be sure to take care of me. And it's, by the way, it's catch and release. So we throw them back in and take care of the river and the fish. It's just, but you said that and it really struck me. It was really poignant.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much. I know the feeling.
You know, when we have the flooding, even when it's not so disastrous as has been the case in some of the recent years, people always ask, why do these folks who live along the river stay there? They know it's going to flood. And I'm talking about the Merrimack, and I'm talking about some of the smaller ones. Why do they do it? Why do you think they do it? And don't say, you know, I've had enough. Let me get to some higher ground.
Well, you know, I think people do it because, you know, you go down and look at the river and it'll call you back. I mean, I think there are a lot of technical reasons, you know, having to do with insurance and having to do with the fact that it's possible to pass the buck a little bit on the cost of it. But there is something that really draws. If you're a river person, you know, you're going to end up back there by the riverside.
Yeah. Well, if you're a river person, I'll tell our audience, you'll want to read Paul Schneider's book. The book is titled Old Man River, and it is really quite a read, and it'll take you back millions of years right up to the present. Paul, a great job on the book. Really enjoyed it, and I hope you have a lot of people reading it for you.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
We're going to be back in a moment with a man for whom the 1946 World Series, which involved St. Louis and Boston, sound familiar to you? That was in 1946. It had a special meaning for the gentleman you'll be meeting in just a couple of moments. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.